Welcome to this episode of Tea with Twiggy. It's great to have you here. This is a podcast where I catch up with friends and people that I find fascinating. I check that they're doing okay and ask for tips to help us stay at home more comfortable. I'm very excited today because I'm putting a call through to one of my dear friends, the very talented award-winning British designer Matthew Williamson. And he's talking to me from Mallorca, lucky thing. Hello, Matthew.
Hello.
How are you? Oh, it's so lovely to see. I haven't seen it. God, when was the last time we saw each other?
I was trying to think, and it's definitely a good few years back.
It is.
Way back.
Well, how long have you been in Mallorca? You lucky thing.
Yes, I guess I've been here about 5 years now.
It has gone quickly.
Yeah, time has flown by. I definitely call it my home. It's been quite a while, but it's nice to hear your voice.
It's lovely, and I'm glad, just so everyone knows, we can actually see each other only virtually.
But
it's very nice to see your lovely face. Now I just have to ask you, as it's tea with me, have you got your cup of tea?
I do indeed. I have my favorite cup.
And what's in it?
It's Yorkshire tea. It's nothing fancy. It's
just a proper cup of tea.
Yes, it's a proper cup of tea, builder's tea.
Tea. And do you have honey or sugar in it, and milk?
Just a splash of milk, but that's it.
Oh, good boy. If I have proper tea, what I call proper tea, because my dad was from Lancashire, so you know, I grew up on really strong northern tea. But yeah. I actually have honey in mine now. But I've actually got a lemon and ginger today.
Oh,
refreshing.
Very nice. Please, I've always wanted to be a green tea drinker, but it's just never happened. I don't know why. I'm sort of quite stubborn, stuck in my tea drinking ways.
So just tell me, so we can all be green with envy, what's the weather like today in Mallorca?
Well, actually, it's not it's a blue sky, it's a lovely, fresh, crisp day. It's not boiling hot, which I never thought I'd say this, but you know, you sort of go through June, July, and August here begging for September to roll on, because actually the temperature drops, which is far more bearable for me. I didn't think I'd think that I guess in my 20s and 30s. I love the sun, I love lying in the sun for hours on end. I can't quite do it now. I get bored, I get fed up. So, and it's hard to function because I guess I'm not on my holiday. I live here.
You live here and you work. That's your workspace, yeah?
Yeah. So it's a lovely day, but it's manageable. So I can get lots done today, hopefully.
Well, I'm very, very, very jealous. As you know, none of us have been able to travel. And I know, I mean, when I spoke to you on the phone the other day, I know you said that your mum and dad haven't been able to come out, and you really miss them. And we haven't been able to travel.
So where are you calling from?
I'm calling from our place in Sussex. Down. I'm by the seaside, not quite as hot. Although it's a lovely blue sky day here today. I don't know whether you know, but we had unbelievably hot weather a couple of weeks ago.
Right.
It was too hot, actually.
Yeah.
But that must be... I think talking to everyone I've talked to, that has been the big, really hard thing for everyone, missing their families.
No, absolutely. I mean, I haven't seen my parents, who I see so often. It's such a big part of my life.
Well, they're gorgeous. I mean, you're lovely. I love your dad, but your mum is divine. I love her to bits.
Yeah, they are very special. You know, I love spending time with them. They're such lively souls and such optimistic people. You know, even in this miserable time, they remain completely optimistic and hopeful. And you know, they're sort of masters at creating something from nothing. I hope that I've learned a few tricks from them. That they, you know, what little they may have, you know, they're sort of they're typical. You know, I guess they're in a vulnerable category. They have abided by the rules, the laws. They've not gone out, they've not seen anyone. So they've pretty much confined in quite a small house with a small back garden. But they've, you know, planted vegetables, they've grown things, they've made, turned their hands to crafting. I think my mum has not stopped painting. I think she might have painted my dad by now if he's done still long enough. You know, they're quite inventive and, you know, they're sending me recipes of what they've tried. And
Oh, that's brilliant.
They remain, you know, as jolly as they can be. But yeah, I'm dying to see them.
Yeah,
I think I'll perhaps start thinking about a flight next week.
Lovely.
To go and visit them.
Yeah, I bet they're desperately missing you. So just take us back. You were born in Manchester, right?
Yeah,
Is that right? And you grew up, all your childhood was there?
Yeah, I grew up in Manchester, in South Manchester, in a place called Cholton-cum-Hardy. And I lived there with my mum and dad and my sister. I have a slightly older sister. And we lived very happily till I was about, well, I left when I was 18. Mm-hmm. Just turning 18, I managed to get myself on the fashion course at St. Martin's in London. So much to my parents, not horror, but they were quite shocked that I got this place relatively early on. I ended up on this course in fashion and I was the youngest of a group of 60 students. So it was a big shift to move from this really tight family unit.
Your mum must have been desperate.
Yeah, she did have a little tear in her eye on the day that I got this acceptance letter.
But she must have been so proud as well. I mean, that's to get into St. Martin's, especially at that age, it's amazing.
Right.
You know, it's the great fashion school in the world, isn't it, really?
Yeah, I have a lot to thank for getting in there, for sure. But I knew what I wanted to do as a little boy. I was so driven, and again, probably my parents influenced that sort of work ethic that they both had. They really instilled that in me, that, you know, that sort of basic, you know, you work hard, you graft and you get paid, and you know, that's how I saw things, and I didn't take anything for granted. And I remember being so passionate about art and craft and design and colours, and just was very curious about a different world to the world that I was in.
Mm-hmm.
Whilst it was a very happy world, I could already see the limitations of it and how I needed to sort of move on, both mentally and physically and creatively. So moving to London was a no-brainer, and I started to look at designers that had gone to St. Martin's and, you know, oh, one day that could be me, kind of thing. And I'll never forget when I did my O-levels, as they were then called, A-levels.
Yeah.
And so my age now. And when I finished the A-levels, I remember you were supposed to go and do a foundation course. And that was really a sort of immersive year in the arts, where you would discover what strain of, what, you know, what was it, photography you wanted to do? Was it ceramics? Was it fine art? And I went to the interview and I was only just turned 17. And I remember the lecturer there said to me, "You're really going to waste your time doing this course. Just don't say I said that, but you really do know what you want to do. Why don't you just go straight to fashion?" And I said, "Well, yeah, I'm glad you said that. Really, that's true. I want to go to St. Martin's." And she said, "Oh, well, that could be a bit, you know, not sure about that. Like, you're good, but you're not, I'm not sure you're that good." So she kind of put this seed of doubt, I guess, this sort of, you know, she threw this idea out that it might not ever happen. And that had a weird effect. It made me think, right, I'm really going to show you. I'm not only going to apply, I'm going to get in and I'm going to nail it. So that's what I did, and spent 4 years on a degree there. And you know, it definitely opens doors once you leave the fact.
Did you have? I always ask people if they have one kind of person in their life who really kind of. I mean, I had Ken Russell, the film director, who changed my life completely.
Right.
because I, you know, I was modeling and it was all going great, but he switched my life and my career into performing as well, which I'd never even thought about. It wasn't even on my radar, really.
How did he do that? How
was he met me and he cast me in my first film, The Boyfriend. So when I did that, it was like, oh my God, it was like going into the secret garden. So I always ask people, but so Ken Russell was incredibly important in my life and changing my life and giving me all these opportunities. So I wondered if there was a person, a teacher or maybe a parent or who kind of gave you that window of opportunity or convinced you you could do it. You could, you know, was there somebody like that?
I'd love to say there was, but I guess the story I sort of talked about a second ago, it was, I had a few instances like that where almost unlike where you're saying someone sort of nurtured you and pushed you into this area that you perhaps didn't know much about. For me, it was almost like the opposite, whereby I had another experience with a when I left St. Martin's and I actually had a job in Monsoon, the high street chain. And I was there for 3 years, doing really well on a great salary. And again, I said, I'm going to leave. I'm going to do my own thing. I'm frustrated here.
Very brave of you.
Maybe brave, maybe stupid, I don't know. But also
that comes with youth as well, don't you think? You're quite brave when you're young.
Yeah, I had nothing to lose, or you know, I had a salary to lose. Yeah. But I just didn't. I felt invincible, and I thought I can do this. And again, it was a sort of repetitive scenario whereby this art director just sort of, you know, hand on her hips and shook her head at the thought of it and said, "Oh, why would you do that? Like, why on earth?" You know. And she was sort of reflecting, I guess, to me, the fact that she wasn't brave enough to do it. And there was a sort of element of regret within her, you know, energy. She was sort of saying, oh, why would you do that? That would be madness. And it was that, again, that made me think, okay, well, you know, I'm going to give it a go. I just had that. I guess you have to have confidence, which I don't necessarily have in myself, but I have it in my work. I have a huge belief system that what I'm doing is from the heart. I believe it's good. I think it's, you know, I'm not blagging it. It's
well, also of, you have, I think, I mean, you are incredibly talented, but your designs in clothes, in, you know, interiors, in fabrics, in everything is unique to you. You know, it's a Matthew Williamson. You know that that dress is Matthew Williamson. You know that that wallpaper, you know, you've got a very distinctive look.
Yeah, I guess
so. You must have always had. I mean, I'm sure it's grown over the years, but it's so you.
No, you're so right. I mean, there's definitely that strong design DNA that's sort of very recognisable, as you rightly say. I don't know how that's happened, and I don't know. I guess I've just learned that, you know, I don't think many artists can, you know, I don't know many people that can do a million things really well. And so I suppose at root, I've decided to focus on what I think is, what are my strengths, play to my strengths. And in doing that, I guess you get a sense of a clearer vision. And much like musicians, I guess, like, or even actresses, I guess you get typecast and you know, doing the same roles, or you might be singing the same tunes and you know, you're known for jazz and then you go and do a pop and it's a bit weird. So I think it's sort of staying in your lane and knowing that you can't please everyone. You certainly can't please everyone. And when you stop trying to do that, then you create a brand signature and a brand aesthetic that people love or don't love.
Exactly.
So yeah, that's, I guess, what I've always tried to do.
When you went, going back a bit, when you were at school, you said, because you said you kind of knew what you wanted to do when you were, what, from about 8 or 9. Was that difficult in a school in Manchester? Because you don't think of that area as, you know, being the place where a brilliant world famous fashion designer is going to come out of, although they come out of everywhere, don't they? I mean, did you get teased at school because you wanted to be a designer?
Yeah, I for sure was bullied relentlessly.
Because of that, do you think?
Because of who I was, because of my difference, I guess. I was very flamboyant, I suppose, looking back. my sexuality was definitely an issue, whereby even if I didn't know or others didn't know, it was certainly sort of targeted.
Kids find anything they can pick on, or I mean, I got teased at school.
Right.
Had no boobs and skinny legs, which actually led to what happened to me happening. But you know, they have to pick on something if you're different.
Yeah.
Which is in the end what makes you special.
Right. And I think that's just age, isn't it? You get to that point where it becomes a bonus and a, you know, a, like you say, a unique point of difference. Yeah, at the time, I guess it was strange. It was odd. You know, he's got hair like this, or he's not playing football, or all those sort of.
And did you kind of throw different clothes together for yourself? I mean, did you kind of get looks? Because when I was, I mean, I'm older than you, obviously, a lot older than you, and I was a mod. So look was so important, and you couldn't buy mod clothes. So I learned to sew from my mum and my sisters. So I would make my clothes because it was so important to have the look.
Yeah.
So, you know, did you kind of put your things together?
Yeah, I guess I was, it was, you know, sort of Manchester, the music scene was pretty, you know, notable at that time. Mm-hmm. Oasis, Happy Mondays, that sort of grunge period I was growing up in. And I was definitely ahead of the curve in terms of, you know, I'd get my girlfriends from school and we'd run into this place in town. It was called Affleck's Palace. And I'd just buy like meters of cheap fabric, come home and knock things up. And then by night, we'd be going to this nightclub. We're only like 15 or 16. Mm-hmm. And the doorman took a shine to us because we were often in sort of, I could go with this one girl in particular, and we'd sort of make his and her versions of the same outfit. You know, I'd do a waistcoat to match her skirt, for example.
Brilliant.
I definitely did that. But I remember, I think I knew what I wanted to do, and my parents knew what I wanted to do when my dad bought me some football boots. The worst present I could possibly have wanted, and I got these bloody football boots under the Christmas tree because I'm named after Matt Busby. You know, he was really gunning for this football superstar. It never happened, and apparently I really cried and took a big strop about it, and they said, well, what do you want? And I said, I want grandma's sewing machine.
I was just going to say, did you ask for a sewing machine?
Yeah, and I got one. She literally gave me her machine and then I was away. So, yeah, it worked out well in the end, though.
So who taught you to actually sew? Because my mum and my sisters taught me to sew and use the machine. Did your mum or your grandma show you how it worked? You know, because if you've never been given a sewing machine, how did you know, you know, how to do it?
Well, to this day, I'm not the best sewer. Can't make great claims for that. I think when I had my business, I built a team around me, and there was machinists and seamstresses.
You don't have to do it once you become established, do you?
Right. The irony. But no, I learned the basics myself. Probably my mom and grandma taught me.
Yeah.
You know, back in the day. But I was more a sort of creator than a seamstress.
Yeah, because at St. Martin's, didn't you do design and textile?
Yeah.
When you do a textile, is that designing prints as well as the actual fabric itself?
Yeah, or both. It was a sort of textile-focused degree. So it was a sort of overall fashion course, but there was an emphasis on the surface pattern. So whether that be a woven fabric or a knitted fabric and you know, what the patterns are going to be on those fabrics. So I became obsessed with that, colours and colour combinations and embellishments. And that's really where I dove into and became fascinated with not only what you wear, the shape, the form, the layers, but what you can actually say through pattern. It's fascinating to me.
Well, I always think, you know, because I used to come to your fashion shows a few years back and they were always so joyous. And I mean, you know, you'd go to a few fashion shows and, you know, and some of them were good, some of them were not so good, but yours was always so vibrant and full of life and colour. And you know, and I can remember saying to Carly, my daughter, who you also know, we'd just sit there going, oh gosh, I want that one, you know. It was lovely because it was just so uplifting, and I think you design clothes that actually women love to wear, which are beautiful, beautifully made, beautiful fabrics, but great colors, where some designers went down that kind of utilitarian, is that the right word? That
yeah, kind of, and like an androgynous look.
Yeah, I don't mind androgynous, and I was quite famous for that in the city. You know, I used to wear Tommy Nutted. You were too young to know. Yeah. He used to make all. I used to go to him, and he used to make me men's suits, but my size, and I quite like that look. But they were always in bright colours. Like I'd have a fuchsia one and a red velvet one.
So, were you interested in fashion right back then?
Yeah, like, that's what I wanted to do. What you did?
Really?
I was at school, so I was in high school in the late 50s into like I left in 66 when I got discovered. So, and I was 16 then. Yeah, my aim was to try and get into art school. I didn't even know about St. Martin's. It was not on my radar, but I just wanted to go to art school, study fashion and design and become a fashion designer. So you did what I wanted to do, and then fate took a different hand to me, obviously. But I've always been obsessed with clothes and, you know.
That's so nice to know, because you meet, or I did back in the day, meet so many models that clearly had no interest. You know, it was so refreshing. You'd see like 40 models to cast for a show, and 38 of them wouldn't really give the time of day to the collection. They'd just sort of waltz in, look at the rails, and you'd plonk the best outfit on them, and then that was that done. And then you get the very rare one, and you'd be like, oh, she's really keen. She's more vested in this process and the fact that this collection took 6 months to build.
I know.
You know, it's not just.
Well, I think because I can sew, I know how hard it is to make something, to do it well. I mean, I used to make all my own clothes from the age of 14 up until, you know, I didn't have to. And then when I had my daughter, Carly, you know, when she was a teenager, I can remember when she was about 13 coming home from school saying, Mum, you know, I've just seen these pictures of bell bottoms, and it was before bell bottoms kind of came back in. She was born in 78, so this must have been late 80s, early 90s. So I, being the good mum that I am, I made her four pairs of. We went out and got the fabric. I made her four pairs of bell bottoms, and then she came back after a weekend with her mates and said, "Oh, can you make some for so and so and so and so?" I said, "No, I can't."
Did you ever keep them? Have you kept any of those?
I don't know. She probably has. And I made her. She wanted a Beatles style suit. I have got that. It's in. Yeah. And they've got bell bottoms, and it's in royal blue velvet with black. It's the Beetle cup with the buttons down front, high neck, and that was a bit tailoring. I mean, it's okay. It's not. You wouldn't probably sell it in the shop, but she would.
Do you look back on obviously knowing what you wanted to do then, being so clear about that, but then, as you say, just being discovered by chance, I guess, and then your career going on a
totally different.
I guess
trajectory.
Not. You know, it wasn't like you were. Thrown into a different universe. It's still within the fashion, obviously.
And also, when I was 18, we did Twiggy dresses, teenage dresses, for a few years until we found out we were being, like, you know, we were so green and young, totally ripped off by the manufacturers. but, you know, I did that for a couple of years. And then, you know, in the more recent years, I've collaborated with certain well-known stores and done collections, which I'm very involved in. They always laugh at me because they say often when they do celebrity tie-ups, the celebrity just signs off on things.
Right.
I think I drove them mad, actually.
I can't imagine you doing that.
They'd say to me, I'd go in for a few hours and I'd be there all day, and they say, go home, Twiggy, go home, it's fine. But I love it. I mean, it's still one of my passions.
Yeah, if you're going to invest in it, your name, and you know, you need to care about it, don't you?
I always say to them, the people I work with, it's got my name on, And that means that most people in the outside world will think I've been involved. So I have to be involved. I have to like the fabric. I have to like, it has to be something that I'd wear. Or if I'm doing a younger range that I think would look great on kids. And like to know where the fabric comes from and that it's, you know, produced properly. And like I think most people are doing now and, you know. So I get very, very involved. And I love it. It's a passion. But you understand that.
It's kind of full circle, isn't it, really? And when you were, you know, when you were, I'm fascinated about your early years and wondering who did you look to? I know who I looked up to in terms of design, but was there a designer that you were...
Tommy Nutter, I loved because I think I was, I mean, he made men's suits. And I think I was probably the first girl that he dressed that style. But then I was influenced by people like Greta Garbo, Katharine Hepburn. And if you look at them when they were, I mean, I think Katharine Hepburn, you know, the actress, was probably in the 1930s. She would wear men's trousers and I mean, she looked very feminine, but it was that kind of look, and I loved it, and I loved Garbo and that kind of 30s, 40s, and it's almost like an androgynous look from that time. And I turned, you know, I had that very short little boyish haircut, and I was, you know, I wasn't the most shapely person on earth, so it kind of worked for me.
Yeah, and do you think it was like, I guess, fashion... to me feels like a sort of pendulum swing of things come and go, things move on, but essentially the pendulum does swing from the monochrome and the minimalist, and then it goes across to the maximalist. So do you think, I guess it's just interesting that that's where you started, but yet you talk about how you love what I've done with all the decorations and the colour.
One of my dearest friends, and I'm sure you didn't get to meet him because you're too young, and he died very young, and I think one of the genius designers was Bill Gibb. And he, you know, you've got to remember, he emerged late 60s, early 70s. And the whole look was very swinging 60s, mini skirts and, you know, that kind, you know, that look, the Mary Quant, Bieber. Bieber I loved. Yeah, yeah. I was very influenced by Barbara Hulin.
I was going to ask you that, yeah.
Yeah, she's, I always say she's like, from way back, my style icon, because she mixed that kind of swinging London look, but quite romantic. And that's what Bill did on a higher end level. I can remember going to his first, I think a few of the dresses he made me are in, they were in the V&A. They might have moved them around yet, because I think they move rooms, don't they? But he did that amazing, they were so romantic, which nobody had in that period had done, you know. They were like they were like princess dresses.
Yeah,
I call princess dresses.
And what about Ozzy Clark? Were you a fan
of
him?
Was a great and I did you ever meet Ozzy?
No,
you're too young. He was gorgeous. He was one of my best friends, actually, him and Celia. I lost touch with Celia. It's so sad. But yeah, he made me quite, I've still got a beautiful dark green velvet. It's like a Noel Coward dressing gown, but floor length, that he made me. Actually, you'd love the print. Next time I see you, I'll show
you. You have to show me. Yeah, he was beautiful. My favourite, I guess.
Yeah, with big kind of bell sleeves. It's gorgeous. It's gorgeous. Yeah. And he was a one-off, really. And great fun. Great, great fun. So when you said you were going to leave Monsoon, was that was that when you went off to Poochie, or was there an interim between that?
Yeah, there was an interim period. So I left, I finished at Martin's, I went to work for Monsoon, and I worked there for 3 years. And then during that time, I got to go to India a lot and discover a whole other world of, you know.
Oh, I can see that influence so much in your print design. Yeah. Brilliant.
I think I'm very much influenced by where I live. And, you know, I think the three sort of cornerstones of my work are sort of rooted in England and India and Spain. I think those are sort of my constant sources of inspiration. But yeah, to your point, I left Monsoon and I set up my own business in a bedsit in Holborn in London with my then partner, Joseph. We didn't really know what we were doing other than I like to make clothes. We just sort of, you know, were sort of on a wing and a prayer doing bits and bobs. And then I remember penning a note to someone at Vogue, and I didn't really know who to write it to. But I just went down the masthead at the front of the magazine and stopped on the name Plum Sykes. And I just liked the sound of her name. I thought it was quite a cute name. So I sent this little postcard to her with some silk scarves and some sketches. And before long, I was in the office at Vogue House and was sort of besieged by editors and journalists looking at this little box of tricks that I'd brought in. And they were placing orders. I remember Alex Shulman literally writing down a wardrobe of, I want a shirt, a skirt. So I sort of had this, you know, moment that what I was doing was by this team of women, where they were sort of behind it and they were encouraging.
Especially in Vogue, which is so influential, right?
Yeah. But it was just that sense of, again, back to what we were saying earlier, what did I have to lose? Nothing really. And it was before the time of emails necessarily. You know, it wasn't really about send a DM on your Instagram, which is what I seem to get these days. I get students sending DMs asking for jobs. And so back then, it's a case of, you know, literally delivering a box to the door of this office and showing my work. And I remember Alex Shulman saying, if you can get a stockist, then we'll write about you. So before long, I did get a stockist, and it was Brown on South Street.
Oh, wow.
Street. Yeah.
Just have to, so, for people who don't know, Brown's is like the best boutique of high-end clothes in London, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It's got a pretty good track record.
Can't get better than that.
Yeah. But it just then spiraled. It sort of went a bit crazy for a year, whereby we had Barneys and Bergdorf Goodman, and you know, every store that you'd want was sort of asking to stock our clothes. And I didn't know really much about much. So it was a real baptism of fire. And then I met Jay Jagger. And before you know it, I was planning a fashion show at London Fashion Week. And I remember Cade Moss coming to the bedsit 2 days before the show, and she agreed to model.
Wow, that was a coup.
And you will know very well that that's exactly that sort of a game changer.
Yeah, it is.
So yeah, it was just sort of like boom, overnight I did this little show with very little resources, and it became a sort of broadsheet headline.
I say it was a big. Was that the Fallen Angels show or something? Was it called that or something?
It was. It's very close to it. It could have been Fallen Angels.
No,
but
what was it
called? It was Electric Angels.
Oh, Electric Angels. You know why? I recorded a song called Fallen Angels.
Ages ago.
It didn't get released, but that's where I got it from.
Could have had the soundtrack to the show if we'd have known each other back then, but we didn't.
Yeah, we did.
But
Electric
yeah,
Angels, that's right. It's a brilliant title, actually.
That was my first show, and that was 97.
And was it the Matthew Williamson label?
Yeah, exactly.
So that was the launch, really.
Yeah. And then it just sort of snowballed from there, really. It just went on and on into, you know, a couple of years went by. And then I got the job at Pucci. I was creative director of Emilio Pucci in... based in Florence, and I did that role for about 3 years. And I guess that was, I was hired there because of the sort of synthesis between what they were about and what I was about. It was about optimistic color and pattern, and like you said earlier, that sort of energy and you know, carefree approach to dressing.
Did you speak any Italian when you started at Pucci?
You know, no, I used to just say molto carino to everything. Very cute. Everything was very cute. No, languages are my biggest issue. I can't speak any Spanish. I couldn't speak any Italian. I don't know. I think I was traumatized in a teenage language class. So
the English are very bad at languages. Let's face it. We're lazy because everyone speaks English.
Yeah. I mean, my daughter now, she's in a, I have a 4-year-old daughter, and she is in a summer school in Mallorca, and it's just like a 5 weeks, you know, little school. It's very cute. And I remember getting the paperwork, and they were basically saying she can go to the English speaking classes, or she can go to the Spanish classes. And without even asking, they were like, Spanish classes.
Yeah, absolutely. Just so that she'll be multilingual.
Yeah, and she is. And she's, you know, she's not going to go through the horror of having to learn Spanish or French or in her teens.
Because that's already the age to learn another language, is when, because they're exactly. So open. So I was going to ask you, what's it like being a dad? Do you love it? Isn't it amazing? Well, I've never been a dad, but I've been a mum. Now I'm a grandma. But did it change your life completely?
Yes, yeah, for sure. Yeah. Yeah, it definitely changed. I mean, I guess we've had her, I say we, me and my partner Joseph, we've had our daughter Skye relatively late on in our lives. You know, I'm 50 next year, so
Well, you look bloody gorgeous.
So yeah, I guess that's a thing. You know, I don't know how I could have been a father any earlier, to be honest, with the career that I've had and the focus that I've had on, you know, I wanted to do what I, you know, I'm pleased it's panned out this way. But that said, she definitely has come into my life like a bolt of lightning. And I'm sure every parent says this, you know, that, you know, all kids are the same, but she does consume a huge amount of my resources, time, energy. So you have to work differently, don't you? You can't really, you know, I like to think I'm quite good at spinning plates. I quite like that, having six projects on at the same time, much to Joseph's horror, who thinks it's ridiculous. But I like to be, you know, in three rooms at once doing multiple tasks. So it suits me quite well that she has me running around all over the show doing stuff. But I'm loving being a dad more. I was quite surprised when she was born that I didn't just jump into this bubble of parenthood where everything was rosy, and I thought I'd be really good at it. I don't know why I thought that, but I didn't sort of feel that immediate, joyful parent-child thing. But I've started to feel it as the 4 years have gone on, more and more so. So we're talking today where I'm looking at her out of the window now, and she's playing in the swimming pool, and I'm hoping she doesn't splash too loudly.
I don't care. She
can ruin the sound. But no, now she's four, we're getting back and forth. There's interaction.
Yeah. I think that's quite common with the newborns for many, many reasons. But once they start communicating with you, it's totally different.
Exactly. And how's it like for you with the grandkids?
Oh my goodness. It's I always thought I couldn't. I mean, I love Lee, my husband, as very, very much, but that's a grown up relationship. But I didn't think I could love like I love Carly, my daughter, you know, who's grown up. You know, Carly, she's in her 40s now, but she's, you know, there's that deep, deep, like I'm sure your mum feels for you and your sister.
Yeah.
I didn't know you could experience that again. Through a grand, I knew I'd love my grandchildren.
Yeah.
And then Carly had Joni 5 years ago, and she's, you know, she's my passion. I love her so much. And it's almost a bit scary because you love them so much.
Yeah.
And it's a different love because I'm not with her all the time.
Yeah.
And you know, as they always joke, you can have them and then give them back.
No, it's so lovely, the parent grandchild relationship.
And I bet your mum and dad are really missing seeing her as much as seeing
I mean, we do a few calls when we can, you know, but I'm planning to go back very soon. I mean, as soon as I can go back and know that it's as safe as it can be, I will do and take Skye with me.
What was the main reason you moved to Mallorca? Just because you fell in love with it, or?
Do you know what? It was a complete accident. It was a really weird sort of turn whereby I was really busy in London. I have a house in Hampstead in London.
Lovely, yeah, I know.
And a friend came round who has a house in Mallorca, and, you know, maybe 6 or 7 years ago now. And she kind of handed me her house keys and said, just go to this house in Mallorca. You look really tired, really fed up. You know, you're too stressed. Go and have a weekend. And I remember taking this set of keys off and thinking, Mallorca? Why would I possibly go to... Like, I just couldn't quite see it. And I'd sort of written Mallorca off as a really dodgy bucket and spade place that I would never possibly ever go to. But I was kind of pushed on this aeroplane to go and just get on with it. And I ended up in this house, this marble sort of pillar-fronted, gated, gorgeous place.
Wow.
And I remember waking up the very next morning and there was a show, like a driver. And this lady said to me, good morning, Mr. Williamson, where would you like to go for the day? I said, I've no idea. I'm in Mallorca. You tell me. And she sort of looked me up and down, this driver, and I don't know whether it was my espadrilles or what, but she sort of looked at me and went, I think I'm going to take you to Deja.
Oh, wow.
And I said, oh, okay. So she did. She drove me. It's in the Tramontana Mountains in the sort of north region of the island, and I didn't know where I was going. And she, as we drove up, you come to a sort of beautiful, enchanting little village called Valdemosa.
Yeah, I know.
And it's just divine and magical, and I was already seduced for sure. And then you sort of do a sharp turn past the village, and then you hit the coastline. And I remember my shoulders in the back of this very swanky car just sort of dropping like inches, thinking, not only is this just epically beautiful, this rugged coastline and the sky, just everything about it, the air, the nature, I just thought, I want to live here. And then we sort of wound down into this village of Deja that's tiny and very, you know, it's kind of blink and you'll miss it sort of thing. And I just got that instinct, that sort of, okay, I'm gonna live here. I just knew that I would live there.
Well, I can remember, I think I was at your flat and you saying to me, I think I've just bought a house in Mallorca.
Right, exactly.
That's probably the last time I saw you.
Yeah.
And I said, oh, my gosh, whereabouts? And you said Deja. Deja where Robert Graves lived and died? His graveyard's there, isn't it?
Yeah, he has a house. I'm literally like, you could meet us away. I'm sort of neighbours. It's a beautiful property and it's now it's open to the public.
It's is it?
A museum. Gallery space, really beautiful. But there's lots of fascinating people that have lived here or do currently live here that I didn't know of, and it's just sort of unfolded, this little village, like the petals of a rose. And the more I live here, it's like, oh my god, that, you know. And whether it's an art, I have such a rich sort of network of friends. I say rich, I mean like half a dozen friends. Mm-hmm. But they're just so, I guess you land here, everyone's got a similar outlook, generally speaking.
And is this, you know, one of the reasons that you kind of moved across more into interiors and fabrics? Because didn't you do some rooms at La Residence? Is it La Residence or something?
La Residencia, yeah.
Residencia, the posh hotel
here.
Beautiful. Yeah.
Well, that was one of my first jobs when I moved here. They asked me to design one of their very big suites. It was a gorgeous project. I loved it. But yeah, I guess it's just, you know, I suppose you talked about the change from fashion to interiors. But essentially speaking, it's been really quite a natural pivot from one to the other industries.
Anyway, it's been an absolute joy. And as I say, I could sit here all day and talk to you.
Well, we must do it more often.
And if you come back to London, do let me know.
Yeah, of course.
Anyway, it's been so lovely. Go and jump in that pool with your little bubba.
I will do. She's been very well behaved, hasn't she?
She has.
A single splash.
Thank you, Matthew. It's been lovely.
Oh, pleasure. Thank you.
Lots of love. Bye. Ah, that was so lovely to catch up with Matthew. I'm very, very jealous of him being in Mallorca at the moment. Wouldn't we all love to be going out to these sunny climes? But soon I will descend upon him. Anyway, I hope you enjoyed it. I did. It was lovely. If you've enjoyed listening to Tea with Twiggy, please take a moment to give us a lovely 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts. It really helps other people to find the show. If you haven't done so already, please subscribe to this podcast so you automagically get the next episodes for free. And do tell all your friends and family about it too. If you want to connect with me, I'd love to hear from you. You can find me on Twitter at Twiggy, or you can find me on Instagram at Twiggy Lawson. My thanks go to all the people that have helped this podcast happen. Many thanks to James Carroll and all the team at North Bank Talent Management. Thanks to all the team at Stripped Media, including Ben Williams, who edits the show, my producer Kobe Omanaka, and executive producers Tom Wally and Dave Corkery. The music you can hear now is my version of Waterloo Sunset by The Kinks. If you'd like to hear the whole song, you can find it and all the other songs I've recorded on iTunes and Spotify. So check it out. I look forward to you joining me for my next episode. So see you then. Bye.
You just heard a Stripped Media production.
Hi, my name is Kay Adams, and to be honest, I'm not so good with the aging process, so I enlisted my old chum, the filter-free Cara McKenzie, to advise.
Could you imagine being a porn star? The room would need to be really hot for me to strip off.
To be honest, she's not much help, but she is rather amusing. And along with some great guests, Joe Brand, Andy Oliver, Anton Dubek, Ruth Langsford, and Craig Revel Horwood, darling, we are learning how to be 60. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.